This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The fun thing about talking about diabetes is that the American Diabetes Association publishes new standards, new guidelines each year. They're published usually in late December of the year before and officially in January. And they have executive summaries, they have slide sets, and so on. And it's important to keep up with the changes, and I will do that with you in over the next 40 minutes. Over the last two or three years, there really have been major changes in the way we care for type 2 diabetes. And if you haven't been thinking about those changes in the last year or two, we'll have fun the next half hour, because there are a few really important things that change how we do things. I have no relevant disclosures. So I'll say a few words about updates in screening and diagnosis, a few words about prevention of comorbidities. Again, briefly, I'll review the controversies in glycemic control, and I'll spend most of the time, I hope, talking about the current treatment algorithm. So there's nothing particularly new about screening. It's just the current guidelines are to screen everyone at age 35. But since BMI over 25 occurs in 60 to 70% of people, it really becomes, we'll talk about this tomorrow, but it becomes part of the workup of someone with an elevated BMI. And so almost everyone that you're seeing who's interested in getting a blood test should get either a fasting blood sugar or an A1C. Back in the day, we couldn't use A1C as a screening test, and that had to do with the variation of measurement. It wasn't reliable, since it was developed really to monitor control. But over the years, the accuracy of the A1C has gotten better, and so now the guidelines are quite clear. You can use either A1C and or fasting blood sugar. I think it's easier to get a fasting blood sugar. Some of the insurance companies give you a hard time with an A1C in a non-diabetic. You need two separate measurements over time. The criteria have not changed. The A1C over 6.5 or fasting plasma glucose over 126. Now, pre-diabetes is a bit more controversial. I mentioned this in the context of lipid disorders, and when you're thinking about, and I'll mention it again tomorrow in terms of weight, but if you think again about the relationship of blood sugar or A1C on the y-axis and outcomes, say stroke and heart attack and kidney disease on the y-axis, the relationship is curvilinear. And again, most of the bad stuff happens when the A1C is high. And again, it gets very arbitrary where we start creating categories. And it's very analogous to lipids and BMI and hypertension too, for that matter. But nonetheless, the consensus is that we have created this entity of pre-diabetes. Remember though, you're on the flat part of the curve. And so there's not that much difference here, but nonetheless, in the United States and the ADA, the diagnosis is A1C that's not normal, but less than diabetes. So 5.7 to 6.4, and fasting sugar between 100 and 125. What's interesting here is, A, we don't treat these pharmacologically. This is an opportunity to treat with lifestyle. The world's best lifestyle study was the Diabetes Prevention Program. It randomized people to diet and exercise and a ton of counseling versus metformin versus placebo. And lifestyle outperformed metformin in terms of preventing diabetes. And so this is a good opportunity to work on lifestyle and not use medications. There are medications that, quote, work. However, it's not necessary to start at that point. Again, think of that continuous variable. You're on the flat part of the curve. Another really interesting aspect of this is that much of the rest of the world, led by the WHO, uses a different A1C to begin thinking about prediabetes. They use 6.1. And this makes a little bit more sense to me. So I think about mild abnormalities in blood sugar that I sort of ignore, and a little bit higher abnormalities in blood sugar that may be a sign of metabolic syndrome and a development of diabetes over time. So I have more than one patient, many patients who get their blood sugars, they're thin, they're fit, they don't have other metabolic concerns, but their fasting sugar is 104, and then it's 106, and then it's 99, and then it's 108. In my opinion, those people are well, and again, they're on the flat part of the curve. They may have a slightly increased risk of developing diabetes over time, but it's very low, and there's really very little extra cardiovascular risk from that observation. So think about using, dividing the pre-diabetes, this is me talking now, and I guess the WHO, but not ADA, think about dividing the early stage of pre-diabetes versus the second half of pre-diabetes in your thinking. Hypertension, the ADA has did change their guideline this year to align with the American College of Cardiology guidelines. That is recommending a treatment goal of less than 130 and less than 80. This is a little bit not evidence-based. It's consensus opinion. And the reason I say that, for those of you who have followed the hypertension literature, know that one of the first really big studies was the ACCORD study that tested the hypothesis that treating to 120 was better than treating to 140 in patients with diabetes, and it was a negative study. And so that's why when they did the SPRINT study, which was the big hypertension study managed by the American College of Cardiology, they excluded diabetics from the SPRINT study. But it was a SPRINT study which came up with the results of 130 over 80, whereas almost all the rest of the literature is still 140 over 80. Nonetheless, the ADA has jumped on this bandwagon, as have the nephrologists. And the neurologists, so I think the way to think about it is that in people with secondary prevention, that is people with diabetes, CAD, stroke, CKD, it's fine to use less than 130 over 80, although it's not a consensus yet for everyone else, and especially in older patients. But for the sake of today's conversation, the ADA has recommended treating to a tighter goal of less than 130 and less than 80. Be sure to measure the blood pressure carefully. The SPRINT study on which this is based used a robot in a dark room to measure the blood pressure, and it's typically 10 points lower than what you get in your office. So again, think carefully about how you're diagnosing hypertension in this context. If I say as a quiz, diabetes and hypertension, you all would say ACE and ARB. It turns out that's not necessary. If I say diabetes, hypertension, and proteinuria, or CKD, then it's ACE and ARB. But if it's just regular hypertension, diabetes, you can use whatever drug you want, but ACE and ARBs are fine. And if you just did ACE and ARB, you wouldn't be wrong at all. In fact, you'd be quite right. But if the patient has other compelling reasons to use a calcium channel blocker or even a thiazide, that's also evidence-based, it prevents events in diabetics. This is something new. I think this was first published last year's guidelines, but hasn't gotten very much attention. But there's more and more attention, and I talked about this a little bit the other day with the PREVENT risk prediction equation, that heart failure is now, as you know, one of the outcomes of the PREVENT equation. And one of the reasons is because there's more observation that, A, the impact of heart failure on morbidity and mortality and hospitalization, and patients with diabetes are at risk of developing heart failure. So one of the new, and this is new, so make note of this one, that patients with diabetes consider screening for heart failure with a natriuretic peptide. So this is an easy blood test to do. There's some insurance variability. You might want to code it as heart failure. But check a BNP or whatever peptide is available in your setting. And if it's positive, then consider getting an echo. You don't have to get an echo in all diabetics, but consider a blood test. And at least more importantly, do your exam and history and think about heart failure, occult heart failure in diabetics. All right, what about blood sugar control? The guidelines talk about assessing A1C in diabetics now twice a year. If patients are uncontrolled, it's four times a year. And so your practice may vary. So somewhere between 2 and 3 and 4 visits a year for most diabetics is reasonable, depending on where they are in their control and personal preference and so on. You can use continuous glucose monitoring, and there's been a lot of literature and a lot of publicity about the advantages of continuous glucose monitoring. The evidence actually isn't super strong in terms of reducing A1C with continuous monitoring. On average, it lowers the A1C by about half a point. But in general, what the guidelines focus on more is that if you're using hypoglycemia-causing agents, like insulin and sulfonylureas in particular, then using continuous monitoring to prevent hypoglycemia is rational. And some people always say, well, maybe it'll motivate my patient if they can see the impact of their blood sugar based on their exercise or their eating. And if that's true, go for it. It's just that I don't think every patient does it that way. And a lot of patients end up getting very anxious about their results. And so it's not compelling to use in everyone, especially if you're not using insulin or sulfonylurea. And as you'll see in a minute, more and more we aren't. So that's something to consider. But it is available to you, and it won't have that much impact on overall A1C. So this is an older slide, because there haven't been any new studies answering this question. But the question has been, when I was a medical student, so we're talking a long time ago, there was a debate at UCSF, a debate nationally, but it happened to be two of the giants in the field were both at UCSF, one who advocated for tight control of diabetes, the other who advocated for loose control of diabetes. This argument has continued on, and I'll speak to it more in the next few slides. But the bottom line is, if you look at the data, the big randomized trials that try to answer the question, does good blood sugar control prevent the outcomes of diabetes that we hear most about, which is stroke and heart attack? And the answer is probably not. And so the type 2 diabetes are a CORD, ADVANCE, and a VA study. And you can see those outcomes were flat. And if you look at mortality, the ACCORD study even showed an increased risk of death in people who were treated. The design was less than 6.5 versus letting it ride to 7 to 8, with a number needed to kill of about 333. But in meta-analysis, we're not killing people. If you meta-analyze all of these three results, it's flat. But there's no benefit in type 2 diabetes on cardiovascular disease outcomes based on blood sugar control itself. Now, the conversation is now different because we have new classes of medications, and I'll say more about that in just a moment. Microvascular disease, clearly there's an impact. And so certainly in type 1 disease and early onset diabetes, we still treat tight if we can get away with it because of the prevention of microvascular complications. But as patients get older and the diseases you worry about are more cardiovascular, the impact of blood sugar control is not present. Thus, there's really no consistent evidence that tight control reduces cardiovascular disease or all-cause mortality in type 2 diabetes. However, and this is really subset analyses, but we know from the VA study and several other studies that there are subgroups who benefit from tighter control, and then that is younger people. So if people, younger people getting new onset type 2 diabetes in a younger person, and certainly people who don't have any evidence of atherosclerotic disease, those are people who tighter control may confer longer benefit. And a clear decrease in microvascular disease. And of course, if you look at those studies carefully, as you're balancing risks and benefits, there's much more hypoglycemia and weight gain with the more intensive regimens. Now, again, this data, this literature is based before the GLPs and SGLT2s were developed. So this is just based on blood sugar control based on traditional medications, older medications. So what do we do? I think most of us would say 7 is still a reasonable goal. The endocrinologists sometimes try to push us to 6.5, but again, there's not a lot of evidence to support that. And the ADA is happy with 7 as a consensus statement. Again, there's a spread of opinion, and so they use a language that says lower goals may be beneficial for some if done safely. And this is the most important thing for primary care, I think, less stringent goals for patients with limited life expectancy or, and this is my favorite line, where harms are greater than benefits. So it really becomes much more nuanced and based on patient preference and how they're doing with their medications and so on. Having said all that, the new medications have really changed this conversation because we end up now with patients on A1Cs that are really, really low if they're tolerating their medications. And we'll say more about that. But the ADA does raise concerns about older adults. And just to be clear, that in patients who are older, they allow the blood sugar to ride up to 7.5. So I think this is very good for primary care. So you don't have to push your older patients under 7, adding another medicine, certainly trying to avoid medicines that cause hypoglycemia. In sicker older patients with more complex health issues, you can let them ride to 8. Some geriatricians would say 9, but the ADA at least gets you up to 8. And again, if that's very poor complex health conditions, don't worry so much about the A1C and treat symptoms and prevent hypoglycemia. But the take-home message here is even for your highly functioning older over 65 patients, you don't have to push them to less than 7. And so if you're around 7.2, 7.4, 6.9, you're fine. You don't have to keep adding drugs. All right, let's spend the rest of the presentation on medications. All right, so here's a case. This is a hard case. 63-year-old woman with type 2 diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, GERD, and osteoarthritis, pretty common. She's on metformin, lisinopril, atorvastatin, omeprazole, Tylenol, and topical diclofenac. Her blood pressure is 130 over 80. Her body mass index is in the overweight category, 28. And her physical examination is normal. Her A1C is 6.8, and her LDL is 70. Okay, so think about this for a minute, pretty common scenario. What is your next best step? Don't start the clock yet, Scott. What is your next best step for her? Continue the current regimen. Remember, she's on metformin. This is in reference to her blood sugar control. She's on metformin. Or continue metformin and add a GLP-1 agonist. 3, continue metformin and add an SGLT2 inhibitor. 4, stop metformin and add a GLP. Or 5, stop metformin and add an SGLT2. So how would you approach this patient? Okay, interesting. So the vast majority, 2/3 of us want to continue the current regimen, and smaller numbers are recommending other treatments. So there's no right answer here, and I'm the last slide. I'm going to come back to this case, and I'm not going to give you a right answer. But let's discuss what the treatment algorithm says, because what the treatment algorithm says raises some alternatives to what you're suggesting. And let's go through the data and the guidelines for that. So this next section may be practice changing in the way you're approaching patients like this. So as you know, there are a lot of drugs, and this has gotten got pretty complicated there for a while, with all sorts of drugs that had some efficacy and some side effects. The important thing is that almost none of them had outcome data, and so we just didn't know about the ultimate impact of these drugs on cardiovascular disease as the major killer of patients with diabetes. And then what happened was with the TZDs, there was a meta-analysis written that said that rosiglitazone increased the risk of myocardial infarctions. And this it turned out it wasn't a great meta-analysis, and I'm not sure if that turned out to be true or not, but it really got everyone worried that maybe we were doing harm by using some of these new medicines, and they were being heavily marketed and so on. And so after a while, the FDA demanded of the pharmaceutical industry that they perform cardiovascular outcome studies in their diabetes drugs, not necessarily before they were released. They were approved based on blood sugar effect, but that then they still had to continue to see what was happening with cardiovascular outcomes. And this has dramatically changed how we think about these medications. So in terms of cardiovascular outcomes, metformin did not have those CVOT trials because it's been around since before that change in policy. But nonetheless, there have been there is a wide literature using metformin, this is not a perfect literature, but nonetheless, in meta-analysis, when you do compare meta-analyze the studies of metformin versus other treatments or placebo, there is a pretty consistent decrease in mortality. So in general, metformin does prevent cardiovascular outcomes, and that is why until last year, or till 2023, the treatment algorithm always began with metformin based on this fact that it was a Inexpensive medicine, old medicine, well tolerated, side effects generally get better with time, a fair dose range, easy to use, oral medicine, no hypoglycemia, and it's been the drug of first choice for decades, and it's been with evidence to support that. In 2023, though, so if you missed this, it's not too late. In 2023, the guidelines said, you know, metformin should know it doesn't always have to be the first drug. It became a little bit of a, all right, you know, a little nuance. You can still use it, but you don't have to use it. And then last year, they basically took it off as the first drug. And now again in 2025, it is not the first drug. So your patients do not need to get, they do not need to pass through metformin in order to get GLP or SGLT2. So that's a really important take-home message. Now, does that mean in our case that you should stop the metformin and then start the SGLT or GLP-1? That's where there's still some nuance, and different diabetologists will practice differently in that regard, and I'll say more about my approach in a minute. But based on the data I'm about to run through quickly, other risk-reducing medications are more appropriate earlier in the course of the disease, and as I said, metformin should not be a deterrent to use of GLP-1 agonists or SGLT2 inhibitors. So this is game-changing again, you have a little bit more flexibility now with starting these other drugs as drugs of first choice. So this is game-changing. And the drugs we're talking about, of course, are GLP-1s and SGLT2s. The GLP-1s are an classic drugs we call incretins, and they're gut factors that promote insulin secretion. And over time, we've learned that they do a whole bunch of other things as well. So the main effect has been on the effect on insulin secretion, but they also slow gastric emptying. They may have a direct satiety effect. We'll talk more about this tomorrow. And they have a variety of other effects. And mostly we're talking about two types of incretins, the GLP agonists, which are the winner in this category, and the DPP-4 inhibitors, which were the losers in this category, and you'll see are very low on our treatment algorithm. The DPP-4 is the enzyme which degrades the incretins. And the idea of the DPP-4 inhibitor category was to slow down, to prevent the degradation, so it would prolong the half-life of your own incretin. And in contrast to the GLP agonists, which were direct agonists to augment your own GLP and stimulate all those effects that I showed. And of course, the drugs we're talking about now are semaglutide and tirzepatide. We'll say more about them both today and tomorrow. So the DPP-4 drugs, this is a good example of why these cardiovascular outcome trials were so important. And it changed the whole way we think about this, because these drugs came out, they made sense. They made your incretins work longer. They lowered blood sugar, and so sounded okay. They got approved by the FDA and were marketed heavily. But when the cardiovascular outcome trial was done, it showed that they, in this case, saxagliptin, increased heart failure. Sitagliptin was non-inferior to placebo for cardiovascular outcomes. At that point, that wasn't so bad. We were looking mostly for harm, and there was no increase in heart failure. And then similarly with some of the newer drugs. But the bottom line is, because you'll see in a moment, the GLPs then outperformed this class of drugs by actually decreasing cardiovascular outcomes. And because these did not, they were either neutral or worse, in fact causing harm, they really have fallen way off the algorithm. And then the first drug that showed an impact was liraglutide. This is a once daily GLP drug. It's injectable. Don't use it much anymore because we have weekly drugs with better outcome data. But this was pretty powerful. This was a study that was designed to be A1C neutral. So the placebo group also got medicines to lower the A1C. Again, it was a cardiovascular outcome trial, a CVOT. And the bottom line was that there are fewer cardiovascular events with liraglutide, and there were fewer deaths with liraglutide. So this medicine was saving lives in diabetics. We'd never seen that before, except with metformin from weaker data. And again, semaglutide then also had its cardiovascular outcome trial, and again, 25% reduction in the combined cardiovascular outcome, which is usually a mix of cardiovascular death, MI, and stroke. And so this was totally game-changing, and it's what put the GLPs on the map and so high on our algorithm. The big surprise was that this drug also caused people to lose weight. And this was in diabetics. I'll show the non-diabetics tomorrow. But you can see that patients on placebo had a small weight gain. And again, we'll talk about the placebo groups in these trials tomorrow. But compared to the placebo, there was an additional 8% in body weight lost. The diabetics don't lose as much weight with these drugs as patients with non-diabetes. It's not known why that is, but the weight loss is nonetheless significant, and some diabetics do lose a ton of weight, but on average it's about 10 or so percent of your starting body weight. So if you weigh 200 and you take this drug, you'll lose 20 pounds, and your blood, your A1C will go down a point and a half or more. So an amazing combination of events, and you'll have less heart attacks and strokes. The other amazing new class of drugs were the SGLT2 inhibitors, sodium glucose cotransporter 2 inhibitors. These inhibit glucose reabsorption in the renal proximal tubule. The names are shown here. These are the Flozin drugs. This one took me a little bit by surprise because, you know, I've spent much of my career trying to prevent glucosuria. Now all of a sudden we had a drug that was treating diabetes by causing glucosuria. But nonetheless, it worked. It does have some side effects, and there are patients who don't tolerate these drugs. And we'll talk about side effects of the GLPs extensively tomorrow, but they have all the symptoms of hyperglycemia and hyperuricemia, which is polyuria and UTIs and fungal infections and dehydration and the like, but obviously these can be managed as you work with your patients. And then, like, again, because all these drugs were required to do cardiovascular outcome trials, empagliflozin, the first, had a substantial reduction in combined cardiovascular outcomes and all-cause mortality. So these drugs are saving lives. And in this case, canagliflozin did as well. That also had substantial reduction in renal outcomes. And then there's a whole literature I'm not going to go into today on the renal benefits of these drugs as well as heart failure benefits and so on. So the bottom line is we have two classes of drugs which save lives in patients with diabetes and lower their blood sugar too, but they mostly save lives also as their primary outcome. So for GLP, to summarize, decreased microalbuminuria, cardiovascular reduction in death events and strokes, and substantial weight loss. And for SGLT2, marked decline, decreased rate of decline of GFR, decreased microalbuminuria, decreased death from cardiovascular disease, decreased heart failure and heart failure hospitalizations, and improved liver disease, metabolic liver disease. And I'll go through this again tomorrow, especially with the GLPs. I think the last time I counted, there were 42 outcomes that were at least hypothesized to improve with the GLP inhibitors and agonists. But in this case, they do reduce cardiovascular outcomes. Okay, so this is the algorithm, and I know you can't see this, and I have always told people never say that from the podium, but I just want you to have it. And what I'm going to do in the next few slides is blow this up and discuss each of these categories. But I want you to see some features of this. So in the older algorithms, it would say something like healthy lifestyle behaviors, diabetes self-management, education and support. They've added social determinants more recently. But then it would say right here, it would say metformin, right? So this is where metformin would be right here. And now you have to look pretty hard to find metformin, and I'll go through places where metformin is, but it's not up here. So the way to think about this chart, and I urge you, this comes from the standards of care. You can Google this in a second. It's sort of in the middle of the slide pack. The way to think about this is if you have diabetes, and you have either heart disease risk factors, and I'll define that in a minute, heart failure, or kidney disease, including albuminuria, then the treatments are GLP-1 and SGLT2. And as I'll show you in a minute, the indicators of high risk in this box here are pretty low. So a lot of people get in to that category. So that's one big bucket. Do you have some evidence of either the diseases or risk of diseases? The second bucket is, are you trying to lose weight? There are drugs that do that, and it's particularly the drugs I'll talk about tomorrow, semaglutide and tirzepatide. And the third bucket, if you will, are you neither of these two, but you just need to manage the blood sugar? And then these are the more traditional medications. And again, so let me blow this up again to repeat that, but that's the way I would think about it. So you have a patient with diabetes, you're maximizing lifestyle and social determinants and their values and so on. And then do they have risk of cardiovascular disease or have the diseases? Two, are they overweight and interested in losing weight? And three, if not those two, what do I need to do to lower their blood sugar and get their A1C less than 7 or less than 7.5 if they're older? That makes sense? So this is user-friendly, actually, despite the complexity. All right, so let's break it down. This will be same thing. I'm just going to repeat it a little bit more clearly. So if the patient has atherosclerotic heart disease or high risk for atherosclerotic heart disease, you use a GLP-1 with proven benefit. I just showed you those. You use SGLT2 with proven benefit. And what's new as of this year and last year is that it's no longer an or. So this is important. So it used to be you had to pick one and then move on to other drugs. This is now an and or. So you use whichever one you pick first, and then you pick whichever one you didn't pick second. Okay, so this is pretty straightforward. A big question is, which one should I use first? And there's really not a good answer to that. I think this is a fair choice. You get more weight loss with the GLP-1s than you get with the SGLT-2s. You do get some weight loss with the SGLT-2s. You get more side effects or different side effects with the GLP-1. So often that kind of discussion is more relevant. But you can use both of these drugs, you don't start them both on the same day. And we'll talk tomorrow about how to start these drugs, which is very low and slow. Whereas SGLT2, you can start pretty high dose right away. It's only a two-step dose increase, where here it's a four or five-step dose increase. But the take-home message here is that if you have the disease, these two drugs, and you use them together. Now, I said there's a different category for just high risk of cardiovascular disease. You don't have to have the disease. And what is high risk? Age. And here, this is interesting. They decided not to use the PREVENT equation or some other equivalent. I predict they may in the future. But rather than using PREVENT, they've gone back to sort of the way we used to think about risk factors, which is just counting a few risk factors. And you can see that if you're over age 55 and have diabetes, two-thirds of us will have obesity or hypertension or lipids. So it's pretty easy to meet this criteria. So it means that most of our 55 or above type diabetics qualify for GLP-1 or SGLT-2 based on the algorithm. And so most primary care type 2 diabetics will meet this criteria. And so it's not as hard to get these drugs approved by insurance compared to for obesity alone. Heart failure, the SGLT-2s have proven heart failure benefit. And it's not just reduced EF, it's also HEF-PEF, preserved ejection fraction heart failure. And again, your second drug after SGLT2 is to add a GLP-1. So again, this is an and, not an or. That's heart failure. Renal disease, if you have albuminuria, SGLT2 has proven as CKD benefit. If there's no albuminuria, you can use either SGLT2 or GLP-1. So this is one case where there's a little bit of a preference for one of the drugs, this and heart failure, for one of the drugs first, based on the evidence that we have. And you can use these drugs pretty late into kidney disease. Now, what if they don't have the cardiovascular or renal disease or heart failure or risk? Then you're moving to the right side of the algorithm now, and it's what if they are overweight and are interested in losing weight? We'll talk about this tomorrow. So set individual goals, a structured weight management program, and medications and surgery. And the medications are the efficacy of medicines ranked for efficacy for weight loss, not blood sugar control, but weight loss. The very highly effective drugs are semaglutide and tirzepatide. And this is what we use primarily for obesity. And also makes sense in this category to use it for diabetes. There are other drugs. Sometimes the insurance companies will push you to some of these. But these are superior and have better outcome data. The DPP-4s are not associated with weight loss. Metformin is sort of weight neutral, or some studies show a little bit of weight loss, but nothing to write home about. Metformin is popular in patients with PCOS, and sometimes there's some weight loss, but it's not a significant compared to semaglutide and tirzepatide. And you all know that sulfonylureas and insulin and TZDs actually cause weight gain. So they're falling off our list. And again, if you, the final category, the third bucket is if you don't have the diseases and you don't have weight issues, then we're just treating A1C. And again, use medicines that are very effective at glucose lowering. And again, the GLP-1s are all very effective. A1Cs of couple, you know, 1.5, 2 points from these studies. This is where you can still use insulin, various combinations, and other classes of drugs. And you can see the DPP-4s have fallen off the list. What about insulin? Real quick, less and less. You know, if you're seeing a patient who comes in and the A1C is over 10, some patients have late onset type 1. Some patients have severe insulin resistance and benefit. Certainly, as you age, your pancreas produces less insulin, and so the incretins may work less as you get older. But these days, most patients can get away with basal insulin in combination with one of these other medications. So I still have patients who take 4 shots a day because that's what they've been doing for 30 years and they don't want to change, but they don't. You don't need to do it that way anymore. So there's no real right answer to this case, and so I'm not going to present it as a case, and I'm not going to make you answer it again. But I think it would be fine to continue the current regimen. And in the real world, you know, all her numbers are aligned, and I think that would be sort of okay. However, you have the opportunity to lower her cardiovascular risk by another 25% or so. So it's a little bit like adding a statin at this point to her. You're not focusing on her blood sugar, but you're focusing on our cardiovascular risk prevention. And again, it comes with expense, it comes with injections, it comes with side effects, and those are the kind of discussions you have. But so any of these first three would be fine, and the 4 and 5 would also be fine as well. I think in practice, if someone's on metformin, my own practice is I typically leave the metformin alone if they're tolerating it and then add my GLP or SGLT2, even though the algorithm says you don't have to do that. But the patient's doing okay, and I'm going to start low and go slow with my other medicines. But once they are stable on the GLP dosing, you could stop the metformin. So it's no longer necessary to take it. It's a twice a day drug. It's a little hard to take for some patients, or in some cases, this long acting. But so you can stop the metformin and be evidence-based. So any of these steps is correct at this point. But I guess the take-home message is, since our job is to prevent heart attacks and strokes in diabetics, probably somewhere in here where you're adding another drug makes sense, even though her numbers look good. So for me, I would probably do number 2. And then as I titrated her up to a good dose and she was tolerating it, I would stop the metformin. All right. In conclusion, tight blood sugar control is not clearly effective in lowering total or cardiovascular mortality, but it prevents microvascular complications. Tighter glucose control is most important in the young and early diabetes. GLP-1 and SGLT2 medications have increasing outcome data for heart disease, stroke, heart failure, and kidney disease, and weight loss, and now are the drugs of first choice and second choice. Good blood pressure control, lipid control, smoking cessation, weight management, and regular exercise is important throughout the course of diabetes. We'll touch on some of these things tomorrow. And prevention of diabetes remains the priority. And again, we'll focus on that tomorrow. So with that, I'll stop and thank you very much for your attention.
Great. Thanks, Bobby. Any questions? Lots of questions from the audience and online too. We'll have one there and then one up here, and then we'll go back.
Could you talk about how and when you use oral GLP-1s like Rybelsus?
I don't. You know, they are effective at lowering blood sugar, but they're not effective at causing weight loss. And there's no cardiovascular outcome data. So they don't sort of make it into that left-hand bucket of the cardiovascular renal heart failure bucket, and they're not very good at weight loss. And so they're on the list as a middle category blood sugar lowering drug, but without the benefits of cardiovascular outcomes and weight. Now, I will say that, and I'll mention this tomorrow, you know, there's a gazillion, at least 20 I know about, you know, drugs in phase two studies. People are really looking hard for an oral medication that lowers blood sugar and particularly lowers weight. So there will be one, and including data on very high dose Rybelsus, which I think is not turning out to be as effective either. But others will. So there will be oral drugs that do this in our lifetime.
Is there an age limit for the GLP-1s? I do wonder because of some of my patients who are older, have history of gastroparesis, chronic constipation. So
yeah, the question is there an age limit to GLP-1s? Not in the not really. I mean, the studies were done mostly in younger people. But there's no absolute contraindication. I think it depends on people's willingness to put up with side effects. You know, as we'll talk about tomorrow, it's such a long, slow haul, and some people do just great with it, and other people really struggle with it. So it really depends. There are people who get constipated, but there are also more people get diarrhea. So you can play, you know, I mean, side effects are all over the place. We'll talk about it more. But generally in people, you know, well into their 80s, I wouldn't do it. But certainly people in their high 70s and people who are a healthy 80, if they're interested, I do have, and I do that for weight loss as well occasionally. I mean, we saw yesterday that, you know, the drugs, you know, the one of the best things to use for knee arthritis, you know, so if you can prevent a knee surgery for someone a medication, you know, and that's those people are over 75.
We have one free on this side.
Can you please comment on fertility counseling for our patients who are fertile or may become fertile while on GLP-1s and undergo significant weight loss, and how we should be counseling these patients accordingly, since we don't have very much data about them in pregnant persons?
Correct. Thank you for that. I was going to talk about that tomorrow, but I will again. The prescribing information is not to use GLP-1s in people of childbearing potential. So in general, if people are on a really highly, highly effective long-acting contraceptive, I think that's generally common practice. Oral contraceptives, you know, the efficacy is in practice is not perfect, but at least oral contraceptives. The oral contraceptives have been, there's some data that tirzepatide lowers the effectiveness of oral contraceptives. So the current practice is to be very, very conservative. And so the prescribing information is do not use it in individuals who are thinking about family planning, and unless they're on a really secure contraceptive or sexual regimen. If someone, though, gets pregnant while taking the medicine, you just need to stop the medicine as soon as you find out. You know, you have a few weeks before the placenta is, you know, developed. So hopefully you hear about it early and you just stop the drug. And, you know, the data hasn't been horrible thus far in terms of fetal abnormalities. So it's not the worst ever. But the prescribing information is not to use it and to stop it immediately.
From what I'm understanding from what you're saying, one of the major rationale for using semaglutide is the decreased cardiovascular risk.
Correct.
Of about 25%. But looking at these figures, that was 8.9% versus 6.6%. So quoting you, it's 25% of what?
Right.
So what's the number to treat? Because 8.9% versus 6.6 is a pretty low absolute.
Yeah, and that's in there. That's a good point. Thank you. So the number needed to treat would be 50. And again, it's just like, you know, any other study, you know, we're dealing with the benefit is it's not that different than, you know, lipids, you know, so we're adding risk reduction on risk reduction. And so, again, that's why it's not you must, but you should know the data and have shared decision-making conversations with people using the kind of, you know, pictographs or whatever works for you and the patient to explain absolute risk and number needed to treat. I think in that particular case, because there's also weight loss benefits and blood sugar benefits, it's more complicated than just with statins, which don't just, all they do is lower the risk, whereas these drugs do some other really great things too.
We have one there.
As we're moving away from treating the number and moving toward treating for a clinically meaningful outcome, do you have a threshold bottom A1C that makes you nervous? Like most of these medicines are not hypoglycemic, so we're not worried about falls and complications in that regard. But yeah. Do you, like, I have patients whose A1C is now like 5.0, and I'm like, should I liberalize?
No, there's no problems here. You're normalizing their blood sugar in ways that reduce their risk, and we don't know all the relationships and all the whys and wherefores, but no, there's no harm in having too low an A1C in a patient who had previously been labeled as diabetic, who's now taking a good medicine.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.